The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
The binding of Isaac, the sacrifice of Isaac. Lech Lecha, the portion of the week called Lech Lecha, it's quite appropriate to its name, because it is God calling upon Abraham to go to himself. The ultimate fulfillment of going to himself is the possibility for relationship with God. That at the point where he has enough sense of self, only at that point can he stand before God and have a relationship with God. And therefore, Lech Lecha finishes off with the covenant. That kind of relationship where Abraham is choosing to be the human thou in the manifestation of the divine I. The Yera is post-covenant. The ramifications and the significance of having a covenant. First thing we notice, post-covenant, is Abraham enjoys a relationship with God for the pure sense of the relationship itself. God is visiting the sick, not because God wants to say something to Abraham, but just for the point of being with Abraham. And Abraham's in this great mystical experience of total direct encounter with God, and we see that his relationship with God only stimulates him towards his sense of responsibility in relationship with other people. The next major theme is the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, where God says, "What, am I going to destroy a city without telling Abraham?" And here the biblical image is teaching us that now God is taking into consideration mankind in the divine process of decision. And that God is no longer going to do something without, so to speak, consulting a human being. That's an amazing picture over here. Right, the divine is going to tell Abraham, because the divine does not feel comfortable to destroy Sodom without telling Abraham. And of course, Abraham fights for Sodom, and we see him use that new sense of covenant, that new sense of relationship with God, that new power that God has become unto him and Elohim, which gives to Abraham an imminent divine power to stand before God and plea for the lives of Sodom and Gomorrah. And we see that Abraham uses his covenantal rights for not only a city of non-Jews, but a city of non-Jewish evil people. Now, it's not like any of these people were part of his movement. And I think this is a very important point to understand. The significance of the Jewish covenant is within the context of the sense of relationship to the rest of the world. Right? Something that some Jews seem to not be aware of as part of their religion. And we see the first example of Abraham using the covenantal right to save a non-Jewish city. And we see a balance. If you read the story carefully, which we're not going to, but you can do it on your own, you'll see a balance between within Abraham. On one hand, he asserts himself. He says, "What? The judge of the world won't perform justice?" Right? And then he pulls back and says, "Well, hey, wait a second. I'm dust, I'm ashes, who am I?" And then he takes another step forward. He says, "But..." And then he takes another step back. He says, "Well, listen, you know..." We see this, his own dilemma, as he deals with this newfound sense of divine significance to his own will, and yet still deals with the sense of his nothingness. And last week we discussed that the name Yudke Vavke, which is the name that we had heard until now, is the name that suggests our encounter with God as he is in his transcendence. And when God is completely transcendent next to God, I am nothing. The divine is completely removed from me, removed from the world. Right? And the whole process is, I shall be, so Yud Kei Vav Kei says, unto you and Elohim. And the name Elohim is the suggests the encounter of God in His closeness. The encounter with God as imminent within the world, and the sense of divine significance imminent within myself, which enables me to have that close encounter with God. And Abraham moved from an idol-worshipping society which believed in exclusively Elohim, right, which is the divine is imminent within the world, and here's my God, and I purchase a God, I put him on my mantelpiece. And he moved from that and said, no, there must be a master of the universe, a transcendental God. And he moved towards a God as a Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. And now we see that Yud-Kei Vav-Kei has asked Abraham to develop himself in a manner which would then expose the truth that God is also an Elohim, and that God is beyond the dualism of transcendent or immanent. Right? But God is so transcendent that the divine is both beyond the world and within the world, both removed from the world and very close to man, and that immanent within the human being is divine significance. And God is unto man an Elohim. Right? Relating, caring, close, and there exists an I-Thou relation. Okay. We now read the portion of the binding of Yitzchak. And I'm going to paraphrase because I think it'll be more helpful. So in chapter 22 in Genesis. And it was after these things that Elohim tested Abraham and said to Abraham, Abraham, and Abraham said, yes, here I am. And God said to Abraham, please take your son, your only son, the one that you love, Isaac, and lech lecha, famous words, go to yourself to the land of Moriah and bring him up on one of the mountains that I will tell you. Okay? And Abraham got up early in the morning, saddled his donkey, took his two lads with him, and Yitzchak his son, took some wood, got up, and went to the place that Elohim told him. And it was on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes, and there he saw the place from a distance. And Abraham said to the two lads, you stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad, meaning Isaac, we will go until there, ad ko, and we will prostrate ourselves when we return unto you. And Abraham took the trees, or the wood, put it on Yitzchak, took in his hand the fire and the knife, and the two went together. Yitzchak said to his father, Abraham, he said, Father, Abraham answered, here I am, my son. He said, here, behold, is the fire and the wood. Where is the lamb? Abraham said, Elohim, God will see for himself a lamb for this offering, my son. And the two walked together. They got to the place that Elohim told him. He built there an altar. He set up the wood, and he binds Isaac, his son, puts him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham takes his hand, sends his hand, and takes the knife to slaughter his son. And an angel of Yud-Kei Vav-Kei called from the heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, don't send your hand towards that lad. Don't do anything to him, because I now know that you fear Elohim, and that you have not held back your son, your only son, from me. Abraham lifted up his eyes, and there, behold, he saw a lamb caught in one of the bushes in his horn. Abraham went and took the lamb, and he raised it up as an offering instead of his son. And Abraham called the place Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, will see. The place that they will say, today on this mountain, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, will see. An angel Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei called out to Abraham a second time from the sky and said, I swear to you, because you did this and you have not held back your son, I will bless those, I will bless you, and I will increase your seed like the stars of the sky, like the sand of the shore of the sea, and your children will inherit the gates of their enemies. And through your children, all the nations will be blessed, because you heard, you listened to my voice. And Abraham went back to the lads, and they walked together to Beersheba. Heavy story. Let's go back. This story is appropriate for our time in particular, because the blowing of the shofar is connected to the shofar of Isaac, of this lamb over here. And when we blow the shofar, one of the ideas is to remember what happened with Abraham and Isaac. Okay? Now, the first thing we notice is it was after these things that God tested Abraham. Let's ask some questions. Question number one. Hasn't Abraham been tested his whole life already? He's already had a number of tests. So why at this point does the Bible explicitly say, and God tested Abraham, when it doesn't say that anywhere else? Right? Number one. Number two, what does it have to do with after these things? Right. What things? So in a moment we will have to look and see what the previous paragraph was to see if they're connected. Okay? The question we should ask is, what does it mean that God tested Abraham in the first place? And being that this is the first place that we find in the Bible this notion of God testing man, so what am I to understand when God tests a man? What, like, God isn't sure? Maybe he won't pass the test? What's the meaning of a divine testing man if God has complete foreknowledge? So then, why doesn't God know what's going to be? He's giving a choice to man. So what's the purpose of a test? Is the purpose of the test for God to know? Apparently not, because we would understand that the divine, right, has omnipotent powers in terms of foreknowledge. So what is there left to do at this point? And we still don't know what the meaning of a test is. Is a test for God? Apparently not. Right. Basically, there are two approaches. The test is either for the world to see, or the test is for Abraham to come to a new realization. See, we understand tests as new opportunities for growth. And whenever in your life you have a new obstacle that comes your way, why? Right? Because obstacles help you grow. It's just like when you're teaching children. You might put them through some kind of jungle gym, and they can look at you and say, what are you doing this to me for? Right? Why are you driving me nuts? But you understand that the obstacles that you're putting in their life is actually instrumental to teaching them and cultivating something in their lives. So too over here. The test is not for God, the test is for Abraham. And Abraham, being put into the situation, will have to call upon new strengths and new levels of consciousness, and thereby the test cultivates Abraham into who he is. Okay? Then, of course, we have to deal with this apparent request of God, or a commandment of God. Please take, which sounds a little sadistic, because really it's please give your son. And yet the divine encounters Abraham and says, please take your son. And that's a little strange. Please take your son, your only son, You know, the one that you love, Isaac. It sounds like a bad joke, right? You know, it's one thing to say, take your son, and for some reason God wants Abram to take his son. But to kind of like, you know, with the thumb, you know, in the side, you know, take your son, your only son. You know, the one that you love, Isaac. And Lech Lecha, that itself almost seems so cynical, because the last time we heard the word Lech Lecha was the beginning of his career, as he goes to the land of Israel, and I will bless you and I will make you a great nation. And here once again, those words. So it sounds a little cynical and sadistical, you know, your only son. And the last time we heard the word Lech Lecha was the beginning of his career, where he was asked to do something which is self-assertive, and now he's being asked to do something which looks like the end of his career. Because we have to appreciate what really is he being asked to do. He's not just being asked to kill as an offering, sacrifice, his son. His entire past, his entire career is going to go up in smoke on this altar. Why? That's his future. We're talking about his past is going to go up in smoke. I mean, what did he dedicate his life to? Love and kindness. And here, Mr. Love is going to do the most hideous act of sacrificing his own son. Not to mention Abraham was a fervent opponent to the idol worshipping culture of his time. And you know what they used to do? They used to sacrifice their kids. And he used to go around telling people, God doesn't want that. Right? Now he's going to do the same thing. So you can imagine, this is the end. This is not just simply one son. This is an entire movement, his entire career. Not to mention, of course, his future. I mean, this is his son. It took him 99 years before he had this son. And now, you know, this is the end of his son. No one will ever listen to him again. It's very serious. It is not only the sacrifice of his son, it's his career, it's his whole personality, it's his own sense of attributes, his own sense of right and wrong. I mean, everything goes up with his son at this point. And yet, unbelievable. What does it say next? And Abraham woke up early in the morning and saddled his donkey. Now, to be completely honest, if I would have heard that kind of encounter, sacrifice your son, right? Well, first of all, I don't know if I would have been able to go to sleep, right? Second of all, if I did succeed in going to sleep, you can be sure I wouldn't wake up early in the morning, right? My alarm clock would break down for some strange... Oh, I forgot to set up my alarm clock. And then, of course, I would say, oh, where's that saddle? I can't find that saddle. As I'm trying to stall for time. Maybe God will change his mind. Maybe he didn't hear this. But the psukim, the verses are clearly clarifying that Abraham is very in touch with what's going on. Cool, calm, collective. He wakes up in the morning without a minute to waste, ready to do the will of God. And he shoots off with two other lads, gets everything ready, doesn't waste a second, and he goes. And it's the third day. Now, why is it so important, the third day? Now that we know that he's going to do it, what is the meaning of it? And it was the third day where he saw the place. And he didn't know where he was going, which is very interesting. It's not like God said, this is the mountain. I'm going to show you. I will tell you. When we get there, I'll say, there it is. And Abraham goes walking. Could you imagine psychologically what's going on in his mind? I mean, if the story was one day Abraham was sitting there, he had this overwhelming divine encounter. He heard the voice of God asking him to sacrifice his son. And in this frenzy of religious fanaticism, he takes out a knife and goes, ah! Right? Would that impress us? No, it wouldn't be so impressive, because at that moment of religious fervor and excitement, he did it. But what's this story? He goes to sleep,
He wakes up, carefully plans, and he's walking. He doesn't even know where he's going. He's walking, and he's not even sure when he's going to get to the place he's supposed to get to. It's 3 days of walking. He's got 3 days to think about what he's going to do. Right? And he's still quite directed and very clear of what he is going to do. Now that's amazing, right? And that's what the verses are surely suggesting. Lifts up, and there it is. And Abraham says to the lads, you stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go up there, prostrate ourselves, and then we will return back to you. The lads don't exactly know what's going on. What they do know is they're on their way to some event of sacrifice, some great event of sacrifice. Important thing, of course, to notice is the two lads that he takes with him, he says, you stay down here. But he says, I'm coming back to you. Whatever it is of this lofty height that God is asking of me to ascend, I will come back to you. Very important, again, because this is post-covenant and the universal implications of covenant. Whereas the clear message that I'm going to ascend some very great height, but I'm coming back to you. Right? I'm coming back to you. Of course, does that mean when he said we're coming back that he knew that he wasn't going to sacrifice his son? Well, it's clear in the story that he doesn't know that because he goes ahead to sacrifice his son. But so as not to worry the lads, he said, we'll come back to you. But he had no intention that it's we, it's I will come back to you. And Isaac is going up to be slaughtered as a sacrifice. And then Abraham takes the wood, puts it on his son, they're walking. And Isaac says to his father, now can you imagine these words? Dad, you know, how long did it take for Abraham to have a little boy that said, Abba? Right? And finally, his biological child, the torchbearer of his future, says and looks at him and says, Abba. Imagine his heart melts. He says, yes, my son. He says, I see the fire, I see the wood, but where is the lamb? And you can imagine the gulp that went on, you know, when Abram had to answer, God will provide the lamb. And it says, and they walked together. Now it's very interesting that it says twice they walked together. It said, and they were walking together. Isaac asks Abraham, where's the lamb? Abraham says, God will see for us the lamb. And then it once again repeats, and they walk together. Now, why do you think it repeats, they walk together?
To show that Yitzchak was with him no matter what was in store.
Which means that Yitzchak knows. The oral tradition at this point points out that Yitzchak knows. He knows that he's the lamb. He figured it out. And now, how old is he? According to most commentary, he's 40 years old. 40. He's not a kid.
40.
Mm-hmm. F-O. F-O? F-O. What? Okay. So, he's 40 years old. He's not a kid, but he's still, I mean, a son is a son, no matter how old you are. And he's taking his son, and he's going to sacrifice his son. And he goes and does it. Now we have to appreciate the differences between the two of them. In terms of what this sacrifice means to each one of them. Because we have to appreciate that Isaac is the first person who dies for, or is willing to die for, oral tradition. Abraham heard the word of God. But Isaac is dying for oral tradition. My father, if my father is going to sacrifice me, then he heard it from God. And therefore I trust my father. Now that's amazing. That's really, really amazing. that he had that personal strength. Because what would you do if your father was taking you out to see the Mets, you know what I mean? It's a baseball game, and all of a sudden you realize we're climbing some mountain and we're not just hiking up here. I mean, what would you do? You'd kick your father and run, right? You'd kick him in the shin and run. You'd say, oh, the old man, he's going crazy, he's senile. But this is the amazing thing over here. We see the kind of closeness, the sense of complete reliance Yitzchak has on his father Abraham. And he says, if my father, my holy father, the man of love, the man of compassion, is going to sacrifice me, then it must only be the will of God, and I will do it. It's an amazing thing. But that's what we have to understand, what Jewish families are all about. And this is the root of all Jewish families, this family. Right? So what dedication is going on over here? And then, you can imagine he's looking in his father's eyes. Abraham's looking in his son's eyes. And these two people are demonstrating completely different strengths. What is Abraham doing and what is Isaac doing? Yeah?
Isaac is being passive enough to allow this to happen to him, and Abraham is being aggressive.
Exactly. Abraham's going to make this thing happen. That's an incredible strength. He's going to make it happen. Isaac has a different strength. He's going to let this happen. Two completely different strengths. Isaac is holding back. You can be sure, as in anyone, his reflexes tell him, kick him and run. But he's able to hold back. He is the master of discipline. When you hold back, when you learn to accept the decree, it's two very different strengths of two very different religious types. Abraham is demonstrating the strength to make the choice and do this and make this happen. And Isaac has a different strength to accept it and the willingness to let it happen. Two completely different strengths. And the two strengths are meeting each other. Because Abraham represents in Judaism chesed, and Isaac represents in Judaism power. But what kind of power? Power is the ability to control. And the highest ability to control is when you control yourself. Therefore, Abraham is truly powerful. He is completely controlling himself. And these two strengths are meeting each other, and it's from these two strengths that will be given birth Jacob, who is considered the chosen of the patriarchs, which will develop later. They get to the place. He puts his son on the altar. Can you imagine? He's about to kill his son. And an angel of God says, Abraham, Abraham. And Abraham says, here I am. Number of times we heard Abraham say, here I am, I'm ready. You call, I'm there, I'm present. Right? Sometimes someone calls you, you're there. Right? Sometimes when you look at people, the lights are on, but nobody's home. Right? They're not present. You can call their name, they're not there. They might be physically there, but they're not there. Abraham is completely there. And everything he's doing, he is actually completely present. You know, some people do something, but they're not there. They do it. They remove themselves. Abraham is there. He's completely present. And in the midst of that movement about to slaughter his child, he says, here I am. Unbelievable. Don't kill your son. Don't do anything. Now I know you fear God. What you didn't know before I feared God? I've done so many things for so long of my life. But now I know you fear God. You did not hold back. Your only son for me. And there is a a lamb. And Abraham calls this place the place that God will see. The oral tradition says the place that God will see fit for his temple. Where is this happening? Just down the street. Right? Just down the stairs. Make a left. Right. On Temple Mount, there is a rock. And that rock, which they call the, they put a building over it and called it the Dome of the Rock. That rock is upon where? The altar of Abraham and Isaac is. And Abraham says it is this place that God will see fit for his temple. Why? So now we've got a number of questions to deal with. Let's go right back to the beginning. But this time, let's go paragraph before that and see, well, what happened in the last chapter that this story seems to be a response to. So it looks like a chapter 21, sentence 22. This is a story about Abimelech, the king of Gerar, who had a similar run-in with Abraham when Abraham was in the land of Gerar, and Abraham used the old line, "She's my sister." And Abimelech took Sarah. And in this case, Abimelech enjoyed a direct encounter with God, right? Not like in the story before where Pharaoh figured it out on his own somehow because he was plagued, but Abimelech hears the voice of God. Interesting to note that pre-covenant, the king Pharaoh did not have an encounter with God. He figured out that Sarah must be married. But post-covenant, a non-Jewish king is enjoying an encounter with God. Why? Because remember, the covenant brings the relationship of God with all of mankind into the world. Abraham and the Jewish people are like an antenna. And just as there is, you know, music being broadcasted from Japan, and there has to be a very powerful antenna in Israel to receive it so that all our little receivers, right, can pick it up, a step-down type of process, so too the covenant with the Jewish people, they are the people that upon accepting the relationship with God, through them the whole world will now be blessed and also enjoy their relationship with God. Okay? So we see that reflected here again, post-covenant, that this non-Jewish king now enjoys a direct encounter with God. God says, "Don't touch that woman." And Abimelech is very nervous. God says to Abimelech, "Return to this man, his wife, and he will pray for you, because he is a prophet." And this is a whole new position. A non-Jewish king sees this Jew as a prophet, a person who has the ability to pray. It doesn't make sense because God says, "Return Sarah back to Abraham and he will pray for you." Well, I'm God is speaking, right? Return Sarah back to Abraham and I will be good to you. Right? Why is God saying he'll pray for you? Because this itself is teaching that Abraham has the power of blessing. And recognize that power to this divine power to this man, that he will pray for you. And what he will say, I will fulfill. It's an amazing thing. Right? It's an amazing thing. This is brought down in the Talmud, that which the tzaddik decrees, God fulfills. Which demonstrates that the tzaddik has so much immanent divine will permeating his being that if this is what he decrees, then it's clearly God's will. And just a little later on, sentence 21, chapter 21, Abimelech goes towards Abraham and says, "Let's make a deal. Let's have a covenant, you and me." So it's sentence, actually 22. And it was in that time that Abimelech and Pichol, the captain of his army, said to Abraham, Elohim is with you in all that you do. Swear to me in the name of Elohim that you will not lie to me and you will do kindness to me like I did to you. And Abraham said, yes, I'll swear. And they made a covenant. That was what just happened before this story. That's the last scene. Basically the last scene. In terms of some great event. That they established a covenant. The two of them. Avimelech and Abraham established a covenant. Right? The non-Jews want a relationship with the Jew because they appreciate that the Jew has a relationship with God. Makes sense. And right after that, it says, and after these things, God tested Abraham. We asked, why after these things? And we asked, why at this point does it say that God tested Abraham? Didn't God test Abraham before? And what is the meaning of a test? And now we can answer. What is the significance of that last scene? What did Avimelech say to Abraham? I see that Elohim is with you. What does that mean? With you in all that you do. What did he recognize about Abraham? The imminent divinity that permeates this man's being. I see that Elohim is with you in everything you do. If you do it, it already has the power of God. Abraham has reached such a level that Yudke Vavke has become unto him like an Elohim. This next story is the climax of his career. Why does it say here and God tested Abraham? Didn't God test Abraham before? You can answer the question. What did it say over here? Who's testing Abraham? Who's testing Abraham? Who? Elohim is testing Abraham. Before, who was testing Abraham? Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. God, as a Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, the transcendental God, to whom next to I am nothing, tests me to see if I know that I am truly something. If I can recognize and accept that God is also an Elohim, close and imminent. And now that Abraham has reached the climax of his career, that people see God on his face, Vayera. You know what Vayera means? It says, Vayera alav Hashem. One of the commentaries say, it means, and God appeared upon Abraham. They would look at this man, they'd see God. He'd succeeded in receiving the indwelling spirit, and God appeared upon Abraham. He had such a close relationship with God. That relationship gave to Abraham godliness. Here comes the test. The test of Yud-Kei Vav-Kei is if you can know Elohim. But what's the test of Elohim? Do you still know Yud-Kei Vav-Kei? Now that you've come so close to God, do you still realize how far you are from God? Now that you've recognized how much divine significance fills your being, now that you've tasted human divine self-respect, now that you know Elohim, do you know Yud-Kei Vav-Kei? Do you still know you're nothing? What did God really say to Abraham? The test is not for God to know. The test is cultivating Abraham to perform the unification of God's name, which is the unification of the name Yud-Kei Vav-Kei Elohim, in his life, by demonstrating that he simultaneously recognizes the substance of his self and is able to stand before God and yet still recognize with pure humbleness how he is still nothing. Do you mean to tell me that Abraham could pray for a city of evil people and he couldn't pray for his son? You mean to tell me when Abraham said that God, won't the judge of the world do justice? He couldn't say that here? When God told Abraham to sacrifice his son, why didn't he say something? Why didn't he argue? Because God didn't tell him to sacrifice his son. What did God do? What did God do? Please take your son. What did God do? He asked him. And Abraham could have said no. He could have said no. And how could he have said no? Because he encounters God as an Elohim. And he could have said no. But your wish is still my command. And therefore, even though I could have said no, and even though it doesn't make any sense what you're asking me, and because of the close encounter that I've enjoyed, and the presence that fills me with the confidence that I could say no and argue, Abraham did not say no. He said yes. And he chose to do the will of God. He chose to nullify himself before God as a Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei. He demonstrated that he fears Elohim, not only loves Elohim. Because when you encounter God as an Elohim so close, you feel that incredible unity of yourself with God. The test is, do you fear Elohim? To fear Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei isn't difficult. When you know God in His transcendence, well, of course, you realize and recognize you're nothing next to the divine. But now that you've enjoyed that kind of closeness, that kind of intimacy, that kind of feeling of such bonding, of such love with God, that presence, that closeness, do you fear Elohim? And when you fear Elohim, you have demonstrated that you still recognize that God is a Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei. Transcendent of me. Because even in his closeness, I appreciate the distance. And therefore, God asked Abraham, and Abraham is completely clear what he's going to let go of his only son, the one he loves. And why is God asking him to do something like this? How could Abraham do it? He spent his life protesting against idol worshippers who sacrificed their children for God. Well, Abraham is demonstrating. Once you know Elohim, and you are filled with that kind of divine confidence, you still have the humbleness to understand that the divine is beyond me. And who am I to decide what's right and what's wrong? This is the beginning of the fixing of the eating of the tree of knowledge. Because the eating of the tree of knowledge of good and bad is because they want it to be like Elohim. Knowers of good and evil, who establish the criteria of what is good and what is evil. And that in situations that look to me like they're wrong, who am I? What do I know? It's a balance. Could you imagine this balancing act that he's playing? He is walking the very narrow bridge. That very narrow bridge that goes across the unification of those two completely different experiences and encounters with God. And God says, go to yourself. This is the real go to yourself, Abraham. Before, when God said, Lech Lecha, and said, okay, did he have the divine sense of self to say no? No. But now's the real Lech Lecha. Because this time, when Abraham was asked to let go of XYZ, Abraham didn't have a sense of self, a sense of possessiveness to want to hold on to in the first place. As he's being cultivated to the point where he's got covenant, to the point where he no longer falls when he hears the voice of God but stands. Now that he has actually accepted such a powerful sense of self, one which is of divine respect, here comes the big Lech Lecha. Okay, now that you have self, can you let go? Now that you've encountered God as an Elohim, and the imminent divinity fill you, do you recognize and realize that you are a human being and still nothing next to God? You see, it's at this point where people recognized, right, some kind of divine significance to the man, that you could go way off. I mean, way off. And then contradict the word of God, the will of God. Think you are God. Because at that point, he had to demonstrate that he still recognizes God in his transcendence and man in his nothingness. After he just tasted man in his divine somethingness. So, Lech Lecha is crucial. Because now he's really going to have to let go of himself to discover the true nature of what is really he. And so he goes. And he's willing to show, out of fear of God, a love for God, a love that surpasses the love of a father to his son. And there is no love that is on the level of a parent to a child. It is the highest level of love. And Abraham sacrificing that love for his son demonstrate that he has that kind of love for God. Therefore, one of the commentaries say that that's why he's called a father. Because he's like a father to God. All right. One of the Hasidic commentaries say, because he demonstrated love for God on the level of love for his own son. But it's quite amazing, and he goes up and he does it. And God says, now I know that you fear Elohim. To love Elohim, to love God in his closeness, is not the test. It's to fear God in his closeness. In Judaism, there are two levels of fear. There's the fear before love, and then there's the fear after love. The fear before love is the recognition of the distance that separates myself and my beloved. But as we develop that relationship of love, we recognize how truly one we are. But now comes the higher level. Now that we know we're one, do we still recognize the distance that separates us? Right? That's difficult. When two people meet and they fall in love, the real test of love is the fear out of love. The fear of hurting this other person. Love doesn't mean never saying sorry. Love means I recognize that you're not me and I'm not you. And at the highest level of the unity we seem to be experiencing, there still is a distinction that separates us. We're not one and the same. That's the highest level. Where Abraham's feeling so close to God, and is able to recognize the vast distance that separates him, and thereby helps him understand how next to God he's still truly nothing. And keep that balance of the everything within tells me I'm something, Elohim, and yet everything from without tells me I'm nothing, Yudke Vavke. And at this point, he's willing to do it. Why then does Abraham say, he called the place Yudke Vavke, we'll see this place. And the oral tradition says, see this place fitting for the temple, because what is the temple? You know what the temple is? When you look at the temple, you wonder why this isn't idol worship. When you see people kissing walls, you wonder what's going on over here. And when you walk into the temple, what was in the middle of the temple, its center, in the Holy of Holies, was the ark. And on the ark were two figurines with the faces of angels, cherubims, and cherubims. No, just cherubims. Right. Bim bam bim. The figures, there are two figures on this ark and they're looking at each other. What, can you imagine? Jews? Jews with images? Jews with temples? I mean, I thought we were all against that kind of stuff. And yet, it's precisely in this place where the balance of immanence and transcendence is manifest. Because it's in this house that we feel the presence of God. And it's in this house, the presence of God, there can be figurines, and yet they're still not idols. It's next to that wall that people can cry their eyes out, put notes, and kiss and bow and walk backwards. And yet not one Jew thinks God is a wall. That unique ability to appreciate the imminent divinity in the world and yet simultaneously his complete transcendence of the world. And it was here that Abraham unified the name of God for himself. Unifying the encounter that God is both transcendent of the world and yet imminent. Imminent and yet transcendent. Abraham left an idol-worshipping community that's based on divine imminence. The divine is in the world. In this piece of dirt. And Abraham searches. He reaches out to encounter transcendental, abstract God beyond all. And yet, Lech Lecha cultivates him back towards the recognition of God as an Elohim. People knew God as an Elohim beforehand. But Abraham recognized God as a Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, as a master beyond and above. And yet, slowly integrates the sparks of holiness of the idol-worshipping community he just came from. Within the context of God's transcendence, there's truth even there. But since idol worship is outside that context, it's false, it's evil. Remember, everything in its final end will be seen with shining, brilliant, divine colors when it's put back into its original context. Evil is out of context. Evil puts everything out of context. But there's nothing in the world that is in essence evil when it's put back into context, except evil itself, which is the illusion of putting things out of context. And so Abraham put the name Elohim back into context, back into oneness with Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. He recognizes once again God as an Elohim. And yet all of a sudden, he's being challenged with the same sense of divine self as King Nimrod, who thought he was a god. And Abraham challenged him. And the pharaohs, who thought they were gods. Right. And that there are many gods. Elohim, plural. And Abraham now is being tested. But his test is now a test through the encounter with God as an Elohim, close and imminent. Also imminent. And the test is, now that you know you're something, do you still remember you're nothing? Now that you can say no to God, are you willing to say yes? Because God is Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. Because God is an Elohim, I could say no. But because God is Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, to whom next to him nothing, the Supreme Being, the Master of the Universe, foundation of life. Of course I'll say yes, even though I could have said no. This is an amazing thing in Judaism, you should know. It says that a person should not say, I don't want to eat pig because I don't like it. Grosses me out, pig anyways. Really, we should say, I love the taste of pig. In fact, I would love to have some pig, but I won't, because God said not to. When I do that, it's a statement of relationship with God. When I say, well, it makes me sick anyways, so what's the difference? But I make a statement of self in a relationship with God, and sometimes the greatest act of self with your beloved is to nullify yourself and say, okay, if you ask me to do it, I'll do it. It's a very high level. So, Abraham at this point has unified in his life God's transcendence and God's imminence. And he set up a place on earth, a place which is appropriate for the temple, which demonstrates the indwelling spirit, that the presence of God fills the earth. And yet with that incredible balance where heaven and earth meet, because that's what the temple is. The temple is where heaven and earth meet, where the transcendent and the immanent meet and are not interchanged, and the borders are not damaged. So Rosh Hashanah, we're blowing the shofar. And the oral tradition says, why are we blowing the shofar? Because on Rosh Hashanah, God is sitting on a throne and judging. And when we blow the shofar, we arouse the attribute of compassion from God. And we tell God, remember the binding of Yitzchak, God. And in the merit of the binding of Yitzchak, God, give us a good year. What does the binding of Yitzchak got to do with this judgment? And the sounding of the shofar reminds God, so to speak, of course, the binding of Yitzchak. And it arouses in the world, it creates a relationship with God to a relationship of compassion. From a relationship of judgment that's happening on Rosh Hashanah, when we blow the shofar, we believe metaphysically we've established a relationship with God in compassion. Why? Because you know what we're saying in Rosh Hashanah? We're saying, God, just as from the side of justice, from the point of view of Din, Abraham could have said no, but he said yes, so too you, God. Even though from the side of Din, everything we're asking for, health, happiness this year, from the side of justice, you could say no. But please, God, say yes. Say yes. That's the highest level of the recognition of God's oneness in the world. That there exists that kind of relationship that even God could say no. And from the side of justice, in terms of what's deserving, God should say no. When we request for a good year, God will say yes. And this is what Abraham effectualized, we believe, in the world. And the blowing of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah is bringing into the world again the recognition and the testimony that the Akedah had in terms of that kind of close relationship and yet sense of distance that the Jews always had with God. And it's only that which can have a relationship. Remember that if God is transcendent only, then we are truly nothing. We are completely void of any divine significance. And if God were completely, exclusively immanent, then we would be God, and there would be no relationship. But Judaism believes the divine goes beyond the either-or of transcendent immanence. And therefore God is transcendent enough that we are not God, and yet immanent enough that we are not nothing, we are of godliness. And therefore, because we are of godliness, we can have that sense of relationship with God. And it's this that closes the whole circle around in Avram's career. The next prime character to evolve in the Jewish story is Isaac. But Abraham has taken the first step in the fixing of the sin of the first man, which was precisely the severance of the name Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei Elohim. And we will deal with that in the upcoming classes. What really did the first man do? And what is the significance of God's oneness? In a practical way, not just theoretical.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.